Good evening. Welcome. Early tomorrow morning, this temple will be transformed into a transmission of light assembly, and light will radiate throughout this hall until Monday afternoon. And then it'll probably keep radiating, but we might not be fully celebrating it like we will be in these next 5 days, this retreat, celebrating the light, the transmission of light. Of course, light is something that can't really be transmitted or passed along or given and received. It's completely inconceivable and ungraspable. We actually can't even see light at all, even though it's filling the room right now. We see all the objects that the light illumines. And it's easy to either appreciate or complain about the objects that the light illumines, but the light itself we usually don't either appreciate or complain about. It's just that which illumines. So this week we'll pay attention to the light, celebrate the light that illumines this world. And the name of this book that we'll be delving into is called Transmission of Light. We could see it maybe as more like a transmitting appreciation of the light. The Zen ancestors in this book offer us their appreciation of the light. And therefore, it's kind of conveyed to us through their appreciation. The Transmission of Light record will be looking at these stories along with a lot of Zazen. And all of you are most welcome to come to any part of these next 5 days. Basically, from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m., we'll just be here, sitting or walking or hearing about the light. And the schedule for this retreat is posted outside, and so it's this open style. You could come at the beginning of any sitting meditation time or any talk or chanting the names of the light-transmitting ancestors. So this record of transmitting the light that we'll be looking at by our Soto Zen ancestor Keizan is the stories of our Zen ancestors, starting with Shakyamuni Buddha, right? The Buddha, the awakened one, who lived in India 2,500 years ago, is where this story begins. And then that Buddha conveys some appreciation of the light to his disciple and so on down through the generations through India and China, and this book ends in Japan somewhere, but it continues in an unwritten way all the way down to us today. So this record starts with Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha is our Indian founder of what we call Buddhism. Many people don't like his words that end with isms because they give us something to grab onto and identify with. But we could just say the founder of the awakened light. and is Shakyamuni Buddha. And since this book begins with Shakyamuni Buddha, I thought today, as a kind of prelude to this week of talking about the ancestors beginning with the Buddha, we could talk about, here are some stories about the seven ancient Buddhas, the Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha, because this record doesn't include them. And they were nice guys, so it's nice to hear a little bit about them. We don't usually hear about these Buddhas before Buddha, so here's a chance. And in the Zen records of the lineage of ancestors, even though Keizan's doesn't include these, there are other Zen records that include these seven ancient Buddhas. So I'll bring up some stories. When we chant the names of the ancestors that we'll do every morning, we chant their names. Bibashi Butsu Daiyosho, Shiki Butsu Daiyosho, Bishafu Butsu Daiyosho, Kurdason Butsu Daiyosho, Kunagon Muni Butsu Daiyosho, Kasho Butsu Daiyosho is six, and then Shakyamuni Butsu Daiyosho. So, once upon a time in this ancient sutra of Shakyamuni Buddha, his student Shariputra was meditating, and just like in the present day, as it was the same in the old days, that while he was meditating, a thought arose in his mind. He was thinking. And while he was meditating, he had this thought, so there's these, you know, six Buddhas before Buddha. He knew about this somehow already. And he's like, I wonder how the Dharma was going in the time of those Buddhas. I want to ask my teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, about that. That thought arose. So then when he finished Zazen, he went and found the Buddha, his teacher, and Shariputra came to the Blessed One, the Buddha, and asked, he said, I had this thought while I was sitting. I'd like to ask you, during the time of which of these ancient Buddhas did the holy life not last a long time? You could say the holy life is like the life of practice. During which of these ancient Buddhas did the life of practice not last a long time? And during which of these ancient Buddhas did the practice last a long time? Could you tell me about this, Buddha, Blessed One? And the Buddha said, Shariputra, during the time of these first three ancient Buddhas, Bibashi Butsu, Shiki Butsu, and Bishafu Butsu, the practice life was flourished during the time of these Buddhas, as it does during the time of all Buddhas, but it quickly died out. It didn't last long. But during the third, the second set of three Buddhas, Kurasan Butsu, Kunagon Muni Butsu, and Kasho Butsu, the practice life not only flourished during their time, but it lasted a long time afterwards. How did he know this? The Buddha seemed to know a lot of things about the way other Buddhas are. Just to get a sense of these ancient Buddhas, how long ago they were, you know, in the chant that we just chanted at the beginning of the talk, we say this unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma is rarely met with. Even in 100,000 million kalpas, you know about kalpas? It's like, we usually translate it as eon, but kalpa is this old Sanskrit word that's the span of time that's defined like this. Imagine a solid rock mountain that's a mile in circumference and a mile tall. There's many mountains like this in this world. So there's a mountain like that. And this is the story the Buddha told to explain a kalpa. And once every 100 years, a little bird comes by holding a piece of silk in its claw, and the silk brushes by this rock mountain, and a tiny little molecule of rock falls off the mountain and crumbles down the side. And every 100 years, this one bird comes by, and a molecule falls off. So the time that it takes for this whole mile-wide mountain of solid rock to wear down to nothing in this way is called one kalpa. The Buddha liked coming up with interesting metaphors and stories to just remind us how long and really beginningless time this has been going on. We don't know how this all began, but it began a long, long time ago. And to convey this, there's this story of these seven ancient Buddhas. Shakyamuni is the seventh, so there's six before him. And the first one, Bibhashibhutsu, lived 91 kalpas ago. So if one kalpa is that time it takes to wear down that mountain, 91 is a long time, 91 eons ago. And also that at that time the lifespan of people was 80,000 years. This is the legends of our tradition. What is there some meaning behind this? Maybe. Also that Buddha, Bibhashibhutsu, who lived at that time, had 6 million arhat disciples, or like enlightened disciples. The next Buddha of these six was 31 kalpas ago, so much more recent. And the lifespan of people was 70,000 years, and he only had 300,000 enlightened disciples. And so on. They became closer and closer to our time. The lifespan of people became shorter, and there were less enlightened disciples. So these ancient times were great, but if you remember this story that the Buddha just said, the most ancient ones, the Dharma didn't last very long. Kind of interesting. Lifespan was very long. Many enlightened disciples at the time of that Buddha, but it didn't stick somehow. Shariputra asks, well, what, Blessed One, is the cause? What is the reason why during the time of these first ancient Buddhas the Dharma didn't last long, the practice didn't last long, and the later ones it did? Please tell me, Buddha. And Buddha said, Shariputra, those first three ancient Buddhas, Bibhashibhutsu, Shikibhutsu, and Bhishavabhutsu, were idle in teaching the Dharma to their students. Somewhat idle. They had some teachings, but they had few of them. They had few discourses. They had few ethical precepts, and the course of the training of their students was not clear. So actually, many people, I mean, there were 6 million enlightened disciples, but the next generation after that, like their students, they didn't have a kind of way to pass it on and convey it, because there weren't many teachings or ethical precepts or modes of training and practice. Almost like those Buddhas maybe were just so radiant that a lot of people just got it just by being with them. But then the next generation was like, well, what did you get? And, well, I'm not really sure what I got, actually. So the teaching and practice didn't last long. The Buddha went on to say, after their passing and the passing of their direct disciples that were awakened by them, the practice quickly disappeared. And the Buddha said, Shariputra, it's like a collection of flowers loosely arranged on a tray. We might make an offering of flowers on a tray, or when we're making a flower arrangement, they're laid out on a tray. It's like a collection of flowers loosely laid on a tray, not tied together with any string, which are scattered and blown away when the wind comes. That's how the teaching was for these first three Buddhas. Beautiful flowers, but they weren't tied together with string, that kind of the string of many skillful teachings for many people and ethical precepts and modes of conduct and a practice program. They didn't have that string, so the flowers were scattered in the wind easily. And then the Buddha says, but the last three of these ancient Buddhas, Kurosan Butsu, Dayosho, Kunagon Muni Butsu Dayosho, and Kasho Butsu Dayosho, they were diligent in teaching the Dharma to their students, where they had many different types of teachings to offer. They had many ethical precepts and ways to practice and relate to this world, take care of things, and they had a clear course of training. So after their passing and the passing of their direct disciples awakened by them, the practice did not disappear, and it lasted a long time. And he said, it's like a collection of flowers laid on a tray that are tied together with a string, so they're not scattered and blown away by the wind. So even though the lifespan was shorter and there were less awakened disciples, the teaching lasted a long time, so in fact, it was more available to more people over time. So that's a quaint old story about the seven ancient Buddhas from the Vinaya Pitaka collection of ethical precepts in the Buddha's teaching. It's kind of a prelude to before the Buddha teaches the ethical precepts. This is kind of like the inspiration of why they're taught. Like a string to hold the flowers, the beautiful Buddha flowers, from blowing away in the wind. Then, after the Buddha says this, Shariputra, maybe naturally, after hearing this, joins his palms together because he knows this is the seventh Buddha who's saying this, and this Buddha has not taught that extensively yet, and is not set up a whole course of practice yet, and has not set up a bunch of ethical precepts, although there were some. So Shariputra joins his palms and says, it's the right time, Blessed One, now to make known and clarify the course of training for your disciples and establish these precepts for all the monks and lay people so that the practice may last a long time. Please, like now we've heard about these six ancient ones, now it's your turn, Shakyamuni. Set it up so the Dharma lasts long. And the Buddha says, wait, Shariputra, wait. The Tathagata will know the right time for that. The teacher does not make known the extensive teachings and the course of training and ethical precepts until some conditions for the arising of greed, hate, and delusion appear here in the Sangha. As soon as these conditions appear, then the teacher will make known the more detailed precepts and course of training. So it's kind of like, I hear the Buddha saying, we don't need all these extra practices yet. Everyone's doing quite well. But we're probably going to need them later. And he kind of makes this prediction, the Buddha knows, this is when I'm going to teach them. He says, the conditions for this, you know, conflict to arise in the Sangha and greed, hate, and delusion to start flourishing when we're going to need more teachings and precepts are five conditions. When the Sangha has become large, when the community of practitioners. I don't know how many were there when the Buddha was giving this teaching, but like as it grows more and more, it gets more and more complicated, right? So at that time, we'll need more clear practices and precepts. Second condition is when the Sangha possesses great material wealth and property. At that time, it's going to get complicated. So we need more precepts and practices to take care of the kind of the burden of stuff. The Sangha will be flourishing, but actually it's maybe going to get more complicated. At that time, maybe they didn't even have a donated park yet. They were just like, you know, find a place in the woods and hopefully no one will kick you out before daybreak. And good luck, disciples. We'll meet in the morning. And later, of course, all this land would get donated and they would have a place to practice together. But probably arguments then arose. The Buddha could predict this. We'll need more practices. The third condition is when the Sangha possesses great status and reputation. Like, nobody really knew of the Buddha. Not many people knew of the Buddha and his Sangha at that time, but when it grows and it becomes well known, maybe also then people are watching more carefully to see if they make any mistakes. So therefore we need more practices to stay on the ball. Fourth condition is when the Sangha possesses great learning and many teachings. It's like, as the teachings become more and more, we need more teachings to clarify those teachings. And the fifth condition is when the Sangha is long-standing, when it's existed for a long time. So I think it's very natural teaching the Buddha offered. And I think we see this in like American Buddhism. When it first came to this country, no one knew what it was. It wasn't large, it wasn't long-standing, it didn't have great wealth and property, didn't have a good reputation, and there wasn't great learning yet. So things could be pretty simple. Didn't really, you know, I heard there were some Suzuki Roshi, our San Francisco Zen Center founder, the first priest ordinations he did were like spur of the moment. And I don't even think they received the precepts. It was more like, okay, you're a priest now. Kind of like a practical thing, so you can practice in a Japanese temple, maybe like that. And don't worry about the details. But then, you know, it grows and it matures and it we need to define the practice more as time goes on. I think we naturally see this just in the short 50 years of Zen in America. So with these seven ancient Buddhas, you might wonder, like, what kind of things did they teach? Even the first three who didn't teach very much, we don't know much about them because, after all, you know, they lived 91 kalpas ago before they invented things like paper. And we don't even know what kind of beings there were 91 kalpas ago. But somehow, in our tradition, here are these little verses that Bibashi Butsu wrote in the transmission of the flame records of Zen. Bibashi Butsu once taught this verse. This body is born of formlessness, like a figure created in a dream. The consciousness of a dream person is originally non-existent. Both sorrow and happiness are empty, and I have no abode. Bibashi Butsu taught. And 6 million of his students were like awakened maybe when they heard that verse. Because he said it with like, you know, light kind of like pouring off his tongue, and they saw that this body is born of formlessness, like a figure created in a dream. The consciousness of a dream person is originally non-existent. Both sorrow and happiness are empty, and I and you have no abode in which to dwell, no place to stand in this dream life. I won't read them all. I'll just read one more of the next Buddha, Shikibutsu Daiyosho. His verse was, by illusion, various good karma is created. By illusion, various harmful karma is committed. This body is like a bubble, and this mind is like the wind. This illusory creation has no root and no reality. So they all basically taught these emptiness teachings. That's what all Buddhas teach. But if they only taught that, maybe the Dharma wouldn't last that long. So the later ones had more to teach, including Shakyamuni Buddha, right, had many, many things more to teach. Also, we might wonder, what is the awakening of these ancient Buddhas and these past Kalpas? What was the nature of their enlightenment or awakening? And in another text in the old sutras, it says, actually, the Shakyamuni Buddha recounts their awakening, and he says, all six of them, and the seventh, Shakyamuni, we say enlightenment or awakening. What was that? They all realized dependent co-arising. All seven of them. Amazing. It wasn't something different. It was the same. From beginningless time, they realized that this arises dependent on this, but this also arises dependent on something else. And there's no original source, and there's no... because everything is depending on everything else, it's dependently co-arising, no thing exists independently. So there's nothing to get a hold of anywhere. That's what they all realized. The middle way, where phenomena are appearing and ceasing, dependent on other phenomena, but none of them can be found to exist in and of themselves. So we might say, what's the course of training and the teaching that's more elaborate? Well, this is what we'll talk about and study and practice for the rest of our lives, hopefully. Shakyamuni Buddha's teaching and in our tradition, the teaching of the Zen ancestors. This week, we'll explore. But a brief overview. We've heard this kind of thing before, but a nice kind of structure, I think, of like the Buddha's teaching, we could see as the ground of teaching, which is like the understanding that the practice is based on, the ground of practice. I think we can't really practice without understanding some basic, like, how things are. Some might say, well, we can just sit down and be present and everything will be revealed. Maybe. Maybe. But if it was that simple, the Buddha's maybe never would have taught all of this. There haven't been no reason. And the Zen ancestors, who like to just sit down in the present and open to reality, wouldn't have taught so much either. I always think it's interesting that in the Chinese canon of all the teachings of the Buddha Dharma and all the different schools, Zen is one school of Buddhism, right? So there's the Buddha's teachings, and then all these different traditions of, particularly in Chinese, Indian and Chinese Buddhism, and the collections of their teachings. And the so-called Zen school has the largest volume of collected teachings of any other school, even though it's like the wordless teaching beyond scriptures. It has more volumes of teachings than the so-called teaching schools. Strange. So some understanding. Oh, the middle way is, we talk about a lot, I think, this year of studying the middle way. Again, there's dependently arisen appearances. Everything, ourselves and others in this world, is arising dependent on conditions and ceasing dependent on conditions. And we can't get a hold of any of it. It's immediately dropping away according to conditions. And a new world is arising according to conditions. And there's no one thing causing anything. It's just a collection of conditions arranged a certain way, called this way. And then this is the result. So that's like dependent co-arising of the appearing world. And then we call that the conventional truth. The conventional truth is things appearing to arise and cease according to conditions. The world of phenomena, 10,000 myriad millions of phenomena, which can't be gotten a hold of, but at the same time, that's our world. That's the conventional truth. And then the ultimate truth is that there's no essence to any of that stuff, any of this stuff. There's nothing at the core of it. It's completely empty of being able to grasp it. Things are not what they seem, we could say. Things are not what they think they are. Nothing is what we think it is. And yet thought and other conditions, thoughts were maybe one of the main conditions for the arising of the world as we think it is. So we have the conventional truth of things as they appear, and then we have the ultimate truth of things as they truly are, completely empty, and empty of themselves, actually. Empty of themselves. I'm empty of myself, and you're empty of yourself. It's like, we're not who we think we are. So these two truths and how they work together, they can never be separated. You could say this is the ground of practice. And we all need to understand this more and more clearly, because this is the basis of our practice. So we have ground, path, or practice, and fruition. This is this model. So that's the ground, is these two truths of conventional and ultimate truth, inseparable. And then the path, or practice, is based on these two truths. So there's also a middle way that includes both sides. The middle way in terms of practice, we could say, is in terms of the conventional truth of appearances, taking care of them very carefully. We could summarize it maybe just saying harmlessness and generosity. In the world where things appear, due to conditions, we take care of them with kindness, generosity, compassion, and harmlessness. This is why the Buddhas, even though the ancient Buddhas taught that this body arises from formlessness and consciousness is like in a dream, still they need ethical precepts, right? And the ones that didn't teach them so much, their practice died out kind of quickly. So even though it's all empty and ungraspable, this appearance in this moment is all we have. It's all we have, because we don't have emptiness. All we have is the appearances. And so with harmlessness towards other living beings and compassion towards living beings and generosity towards living beings and kindness towards living beings, we meet in the dream world and take care of each other. So that practice goes with the conventional truth. And then there's the ultimate truth of emptiness. The practice that goes with that is, or the path, or practice that goes with that is, say, wisdom, the understanding and realization of this emptiness, or that things are not what they seem, at the same time that we're taking care of the seeming arisings. So based on the ground of the conventional truth, there's the practice of harmlessness and kindness and generosity. Based on the ultimate truth of emptiness, there's the practice of dropping off body and mind, opening to ungraspability, letting go of all conceptual thought that creates this world. And those two practices also go very nicely together. The middle way doesn't neglect either one of them. They're not contradictory. They're also a unity. In dropping off body and mind, a body and mind can appear. So, and then the fruition. So we have ground of understanding, the path of practice, and then the fruition also has these two sides. Based on the ground of the conventional appearances and the practice of kindness and harmlessness is the fruition of what we call in Buddha's teaching the form bodies. This is like a story of what Buddha is. Buddha has these three bodies. Buddha is these three bodies. Two of them together are called the form bodies, the rupakayas. And the form body is like the manifestation in the world that responds to beings' needs and meets others with compassion. And then based on the ground of the ultimate truth and the practice of realizing emptiness, dropping off all our ideas of everything, there's the fruition of the Dharmakaya, the formless reality body. And these two bodies also, it's like a middle way. They're inseparable. We can't get stuck in one side or the other because they can't be separated. The Buddha's Dharmakaya always manifests as the Rupakaya to help others. So that's kind of a overview of the Buddha's whole system. And then, you know, when we're looking at practice, we can clarify the ground and understanding of these two truths of the appearances and reality, what that means over and over. It's hard to understand this, very hard, but I think it's very important too. And then the practice, based on that, we need to emphasize both these sides. We emphasize the compassion, kindness, generosity, ethical conduct, harmlessness side, but that's not the whole of the Buddha Dharma. If it was, it also wouldn't have lasted to this day. We need to realize that none of this is what we think it is. We can't hold on to any of it. But if we just have that side, then what's the point of living in this world? So always together. We can't really have one side or the other. It's just a way of talking to clarify. And then the fruition. Where are we heading in this practice? We like to talk about, well, not heading anywhere. There's no goal here. There's value in that teaching because we don't want to be striving for some future thing. And yet, to clarify, there is a path that leads in a direction. And I think it's helpful to know this possibility of the Dharmakaya, our own Dharmakaya, reality, body, just like the nature of this mind as it is already perfectly boundless and radiant. And the Rupakaya, from this boundless radiance of mind, we emerge into a world of others that we can respond to. So that's a little about the seven ancient Buddhas and some of their teachings and some of Shakyamuni Buddha's more extensive teachings about what we're doing in this practice. Any thoughts or questions or comments? Or about this upcoming transmission of light, Sesshin? Yes.
How does the Rupakaya, which I haven't heard before?
Rupakaya, yeah. Rupa means form. Mm-hmm.
How does that relate to Sambhogakaya?
Yeah, so some people have heard of Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya when we talk about three bodies of Buddha.
Yes.
So the Sambhogakaya is like the sometimes say the reward body of the Buddha. It's like a, or sometimes also translated as the bliss body of Buddha. That's like from the Dharmakaya, from the realization that there's nothing to hold on to anywhere, and the full extent of that realization obviously is maybe we could say obviously is is blissful because there's no holding on to anything. Bliss is a bit strong word. Maybe it's too much for us, right? But like, I think deep joy and peace there is at any moment when we're not holding on to anything. At any moment. I think we all have those experiences. Everybody has experienced great joy and peace. And if you look back at those moments, if it's true joy and peace, I propose that that's a moment of not holding on to anything. Our mind is not trying to do anything. We're just enjoying suchness, right? So that we could say that's the Sambhogakaya. And there's lots of fancy stuff that the Buddhas talk about that, but we could leave it at that. And Nirmanakaya is the more like appearance of a person like Shakyamuni Buddha. We could say like the manifestation body.
Embodiment.
An embodiment. Yeah, an embodiment. Because bliss is maybe still not quite embodied. They say it's like a kind of subtle body that other bliss bunnies can relate to. But we have trouble seeing them. But the Nirmanakaya, we, like Shakyamuni Buddha, many people saw the Buddha's manifestation. And the reason that manifestation of Shakyamuni Buddha walking around India was just to help people, just to benefit others, that Nirmanakaya. So those two together are sometimes called the Rupakaya. And it makes a nice little package of, if we're talking about the middle way, that's the kind of union of these two different sides. The middle way, that's a union of, should we do a quiz? This is nice to see if people are awake. The ground of practice, the ground or understanding, is the union of what two?
Absolute knowledge.
Yes, yeah, absolute or ultimate and relative truths. So it's the ground is like an understanding of what truth it means, mm-hmm. And then the path or the the path or the practice is a union of a middle way, a union of what two? I might not have said it in two words, but do you remember? They relate to the two practices that relate to those two truths.
Oh, the compassion and kindness and wisdom?
Yeah. Compassion and kindness is the practice based on the conventional truth, and the wisdom is the practice, we could say, based on the ultimate truth. Wisdom is like the understanding of the ground of ultimate truth.
To know what to do when.
We might even say to know what to do when might fit into the to the conventional side of responding to beings, right? Because in this wisdom, this kind of wisdom side, like prajnaparamita, is like just not grasping anything at all. So it almost doesn't even know what to do when. But then it needs to know what to do when. So that's why we have this unity of what's that? Yeah, maybe the ultimate's a little bit more like thy will be done, letting us be done. And then, but when we get into the nitty-gritty details of that, we're like, how should we do it? And in the most compassionate way, we try and we fail. Also, confession is a part of the practice on the conventional side. And then the fruition, the kind of like, you could say the fruition is based on the ground. The practice is based on the ground, and then the fruition is the culmination of the practice. And the fruition is a middle way that's the unity of two. And we're there. Well, the fruition is these two bodies. Two bodies of Buddha. Buddha bodies, the Dharmakaya, which is, you know, to make that, we might say, well, what is, this is getting too metaphysical and weird. What do you mean with this reality body of Buddha? My understanding really is it's like when we're just resting totally, totally present in Zazen and letting go of everything and, just present, aware of what's happening, and then, as I've said here many times, like this little shift back to like, well, who's aware right now? When we actually like open to that big who, boundless who, I would call that the Dharmakaya, actually. And then the Rupakaya is like, so what? Now what's it gonna, how is it gonna help? How's it gonna meet? How is that boundless awareness called the Dharmakaya going to like do the next thing? Rupakaya. So can you follow that? I just think it's a neat little summary of the, I'd say the entire Buddha Dharma, Buddha's teaching. We have an understanding, a middle way understanding, a middle way path, and a middle way fruition or final completion in any given moment. Yes?
So it seems like the path and the fruition overlap an awful lot.
Yeah, all three overlap a lot, yeah. We could even also say
more about the distinction between fruition and path, because every moment of the path is that merging of.
Yeah. Well, maybe like the tradition might say, and you know, we in Zen, particularly Dogen Zen, our version of Zen, we say practice and realization are not two, right? So a moment of complete practice is a moment of confirmation of the fruition in a way. So I think you kind of picked up on that point, that actually, according to Dogen, the path and the fruition are not two. But the tradition will also make that point of like you could be it's a little bit more dualistic to talk this way, because Dogen tries to avoid this by saying the practice and the fruition, even we could say, are not two. But before Dogen, people would say, well, you are practicing and you're kind of falling off the practice and you're getting back up onto the practice and you're falling off. We, you know, due to all our habitual patterns, we keep losing it. But when the practice is, there's continuity in the practice. Continuity without falling off. Hard to imagine this, myself. Hard to imagine. But, I kind of like, when the practice is completely in accord with these two truths, and the understanding is complete, and the practice is complete, and that the realization of emptiness doesn't hinder the compassionate response. In fact, it increases it, and the compassionate response doesn't hinder the emptiness. In fact, it deepens it. And those are completely one unity, and in a, I'd say continuity is the key here. Jiryu talked about last week that one of, on his scale of meditation, one of the things was continuity, like how continuous, exactly, I could say continuous. When it's continuous, then we could say that's the fruition. And it's also interesting that the fruition is really just the same as the ground, actually, too. And the path, kind of like, you know, almost like the fruition is the real, full realization of the ground, and the path is what bridges them. Yes, Richard.
Just speaking for me, I don't know school.
Yeah.
To me, the thought that everything has to do with co-dependent arising.
Yeah, dependent co-arising. It would make it impossible for anything to arise.
If one thing depends on the other to arise, nothing can arise.
Yeah, as an actual thing, no thing can arise. Yeah.
Sense or form, but even possibly even
utter can form. There you have it, beautifully. That's the unity of the two truths. Because of dependent co-arising, no thing can actually arise. Yeah. And I don't know if everybody got Richard's like insight there, but that's exactly the case. However, there are appearances every moment of, it seems like things are here, but they're just, that's why all this talk about dreamlike body and dreamlike consciousness is, all that stuff is just one moment of appearance. When its conditions are a certain way, like a hologram, like a rainbow. And yet, if we say there's no rainbow, no hologram, and no appearance, then that gets like towards the side of suicide. But in fact, we live in a world of rainbows. I mean, we can rejoice. Sometimes they're painful rainbows, of course, but the more we see the rainbow-like nature of the painful experiences, the more we can maybe even rejoice in them too. And if this whole ultimate side of the spectrum of these two sides, we might say, well, how about just skip that? That seems like, I don't know what's going on with there. Let's just do the like, things are arising. Let's take care of that. Let's have a practice that deals with things that arise, like this body and this breath and this mind. And let's have this fruition body that, is just compassionate response. Why do we need the other side? Seems like we need the other side. So it's not just our idea of what we think we're doing here, right? And they're not really two sides anyway. And of course, if we just had the empty wisdom Dharmakaya side, then there's nothing to do. And there is stuff to do, so we have to end the talk and do the next thing. And Sit Sesshin, again, you're all most welcome to come. Sesshin's a great celebration of like following a schedule where it seems like, and forms where it seems like there's lots to do, but it's about like nothing to do all day long. It's a strange ceremony, 5-day ceremony we do. May any positive energy gathered in this conventionally appearing assembly tonight be dedicated and conveyed and touch all appearing beings everywhere, So they open more and more to this middle way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.